This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the finance plutocracy and the $24 trillion heist. On July 22, 2009, two articles appeared that were quite revealing about what is happening now in the United States. The Christian Science Monitor editorial started this way. The recession is changing the makeup of homelessness in America to include more families and more people in suburbs and rural areas. Last year, the number of individuals who used a shelter or other transitional housing in the United States basically held steady at 1.6 million people. But the number of people in homeless families, the Monitor noted, typically a mother with two children, increased by 9% overall this year. Alarmingly, it rose by more than 50% in suburban and rural areas. In all, more than 500,000 individuals in families were homeless last year, about a third of the homeless population. So noted the Christian Science Monitor. But at the same time, the Financial Times in Great Britain, as well as the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers in the United States, noted something else. Goldman sheds bailout legacy, noted Greg Farrell, writing for the Financial Times. Goldman Sachs became the first major bank to buy back warrants held by the U.S. Treasury on Wednesday, allowing the group to shake off the last vestige of its participation in the government bailout program after just 9 months. This was following articles about U.S. banks turning $7.6 billion in profits. The nation's banks turned a profit in the first quarter was the headline. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said higher trading revenues at big banks helped the industry earn a $7.6 billion profit in the January to March period, compared with a record loss of $36.9 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. Many more people unemployed, increased number of homeless, while U.S. banks turn in massive profits, paying their executives enormous bonuses. These are the articles that you see daily now in the press. How did the banks turn this profit? What is really going on? Ralph?
Well, Maya, you mentioned the crisis in employment and in jobs. I want to cite here in July 26, the New York Times, the way we live now, the new joblessness. The United States economy, writes Roger Lowenstein, is not only shedding jobs at a record rate, it is shedding more jobs than it's supposed to. It's bad enough that the unemployment rate has doubled in a year and a half, that one out of six construction workers is out of work. But what truly troubles economic advisors is that even adjusting for recession, the contraction in employment seems way too high. As one Obama official said, this has been a very steep job loss. The country is deviating from the standard jobs predictor known as Occam's Law. Now, this article, which we'll go into at a later program, is part of a process through which the immiseration of the mass of our population is accelerating at such a pace that we can only understand it in the context of the banker's government, the finance capital's dictatorship in the United States. As the Wall Street Journal puts it on its article of July 27, 2009, banks get billions from backing. The article by Mark Gongloff says, the article begins actually, it's the gift that keeps on giving. The government's guarantees on new debt issued by financial firms such as Citigroup and General Electric saves these companies $24 billion in borrowing costs over 3 years, according to an analysis of the Wall Street Journal. In the second quarter alone, the eighth largest issuers of corporate debt under the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Term Liquidity Guarantee Program cut their interest costs by $2.2 billion, increasing their profits usually and delivering an extra jolt to the stock market's two-week rally. And what we're talking about here, brothers and sisters, is the absolute profiteering arising from the near, as we'll show you, $24 trillion of handouts to this small, tiny banking plutocracy. Liam?
Ralph, Goldman alone, their profits nearly doubled, reaching $3.44 billion compared to $1.8 billion in the first quarter and $2 billion a year ago. This is 35% higher than a survey of economists conducted by Bloomberg News had predicted. Goldman's net revenue reached $13.8 billion in the second quarter, up 46% from the same quarter of 2008. What are they doing with these earnings? The Wall Street Bank set aside $6.6 billion, nearly half of its quarterly revenue, for compensation, a 41% increase from the first 3 months of the year. It earmarked $11.3 billion for salaries and bonuses for the first 6 months of 2009. Compare this with the increased unemployment and the increase in homelessness. Citigroup and Bank of America profits were aided by asset sales, wrote Michael J. Lumersed, July 18th in the New York Times, just a few days before those July 22nd articles. And he notes, Bank of America and Citigroup giants have come to symbolize the ills plaguing the banking industry. When they announced that they had set aside billions of additional dollars to cope with looming losses on everything from credit cards to home equity loans. Michael Lemerced is saying that despite all the enormous profits noted by the banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and so on, underneath it all, the banks are in trouble. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. The article makes very clear what we have going on. Like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase, two banks that stunned Wall Street with robust earnings reports, Bank of America and Citigroup got huge lifts from their trading operations. Bank of America reported a $3.2 billion profit for the second quarter. Citigroup said it earned a $4.3 billion profit. Now understand this, brothers and sisters. Their toxic assets from their speculation and their derivatives and their fictive capital have all been subsidized by the taxpayers, by the U.S. government. And the consequence of this has been enormous profits because they're guaranteed that their toxic assets will be subsidized by the government and that all will be left to them is to make more profits with the subsidy of the what we now see to be $23.7 trillion. But as the article says, the pain being felt by ordinary Americans will hurt these giants even more. Setting aside billions of dollars to cover potential losses on consumer loans means that the road ahead will be rocky. And what we're looking at here is the essentially doomsday mentality of the plutocracy, grabbing the trillions, raping the economy, absolutely pillaging everything that isn't nailed down into society as a quick fix for them without any expectation that it will solve the inherent structural crisis of late capital. The next crisis will be even greater.
The information is becoming revealed. But this doesn't make big headlines. No, you don't see it on the front page of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But hidden in the articles we have on July 21st, the statement of Neil Barofsky, the Special Inspector General of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP. He spoke before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and these were his words. In the 9 months since the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, the EESE, that authorized the creation of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, the U.S. Department of Treasury has created 12 separate programs involving government and private funds of up to almost $3 trillion. From programs involving large capital infusion into hundreds of banks and other financial institutions to a mortgage modification program designed to modify millions of mortgages to public-private partnerships using tens of billions of taxpayer dollars to purchase toxic assets from banks, TARP has evolved into a program of unprecedented scope and scale and complexity. But this is only the beginning of the story. After all, TARP was to be a much smaller program, $700 billion worth of toxic assets. They call it toxics. These are the troubled mortgages and mortgage-backed securities that the banks foisted on the public. But that framework was soon shelved, says Borofsky, and the TARP funds are being used or have been announced to be used in connection with 12 other separate programs. As massive and as important as TARP is on its own, he says, it is just one part of a much broader federal government effort to stabilize and support the financial system. Since the outset of the financial crisis in 2007, the federal government, through many agencies, has implemented dozens of programs that are broadly designed to support the economy and financial system. He then reveals the total potential federal government support could reach up to $23.7 trillion. And all of this is being done in secret. Ralph.
Over the past nearly a year now, brothers and sisters, we at Taking Aim, I and I, have been attempting to explain that in the crisis of fictive capital, there is no exit other than the absolute total subsidization of these banksters with their speculation on a paper-shuffling Ponzi scheme that defines the crisis of fictitious capital, fictive capital that was described in the third volume of Capital by Karl Marx and in the classic work by Rudolf Hilferding in 1913 called Finance Capital, which examines what is in fact a completely arbitrary, speculative, paper-shuffling, fictive capital, the invention of paper on speculation basis, on deriving future values that are completely without a collateral base, de-linking this from the actual production in the society, abandoning productive forces, completely scuttling the manufacturing base because you can't make enough money out of it. The exploitation of workers cannot compare with the trillions upon trillions of arbitrarily derived value. You print money, you print paper, you speculate on the paper, you trade the paper on which you're speculating, you give it an arbitrary value, and you put into control of the entire government apparatus the very banksters, the schemers, the Ponzi scheme operatives, the relentlessly ruthless and rapacious criminal gang, this kleptocracy that is the ruling class in the United States. We have been talking about how the numbers are in no way related to the acknowledged figures. Barack Obama and Bush together were talking about $3 trillion. The number then was described as $7 trillion. Then when we were describing it, we said the actual numbers are more like $13 trillion. Here is what is revealed by Borofsky as an extraordinary report. Nearly $24 trillion. Any assessment of this has to be made, he writes, in the context of this broader undertaking. Well, let's break that down. First of all, what does it mean to be talking about nearly $24 trillion in this world economy? None of the actual productive capacities and economic output of the vast majority of nation states even approximates $23.7 trillion. All of the assets and all of the value of produced labor is dwarfed by $23.7 trillion. Everything that has been accumulated, has been assembled, is being handed over to this tiny little plutocracy to enrich itself further and to speculate yet more with no control and no visibility as to what has become of the money and no right to inquire after it, which is what the Borofsky report documents.
Ralph, as Borofsky had said, TARP does not function in a vacuum. And remember that it was the Treasury saying that they needed the $700 billion, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and that was going to be the extent of the Federal Reserve buying these so-called troubled assets from the banks, getting them off their balance sheet so that the banks could function, freeing up the credit markets, and that was the extent of the program. But what Borofsky revealed, he said, TARP does not function in a vacuum. It It's the most visible effort to counter the financial meltdown, but that isn't where it ended. The top Republican on the Oversight Committee, Representative Daryl Issa of California, looked at Borofsky and said, if you spent $1 million a day going back to the birth of Christ, that wouldn't even come close to $1 trillion. $23.7 trillion is a staggering figure. Well, I did the computation, and what you have is over $30 million a day since the birth of Christ. Even the Wall Street Journal had a headline, $23.7 trillion. Really?
Maya, you know, actually, that number, about $1 million a day, and it's $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus, that represents $1 trillion. $1 trillion. $23.7 trillion is an enormous multiple of this figure, of course. The economy cannot survive this load of debt. No functioning economy can. The bankers themselves have no capacity to resolve any of the abiding societal needs that flow from this capture of all value in the society. And the Borofsky Report is, in its dry and academic way, an extraordinary exposure of just exactly this critique that we have been making on Taking Aim for the entire length of this financial crisis. Quote, although Treasury has taken some steps to improving transparency, it has repeatedly failed to adopt recommendations essential to providing elementary transparency, use of funds generally. All TARP recipients were supposed to report on the actual use of the TARP funds. Other than a few token agreements, he writes, the Treasury has declined to adopt this recommendation, calling reporting on the use of the money meaningless in the light of what is called the inherent fungibility of money. The banks are unwilling and unobliged to provide any meaningful information, he writes, about what they are doing with TARP funds. And he says, valuation of the TARP portfolio begins by reporting on the value so that taxpayers could get actual updates on financial performance. Notwithstanding that, there is no such reporting. There is no such information being allowed. There is no such disclosure actually taking place. The loans are non-recourse, he says. That is, the lender will have no recourse against the borrower. Under the program, should such a collateral surrender occur, TARP funds would be used to purchase the surrendered capital. In the light of this use of TARP funds, the Federal Reserve disclosure of the identity of the borrowers displays that they have failed to repay the TALF loans. Regular disclosure of PPIF, which is the legacy of a securities program, the taxpayer is providing the substantial portion of the funds to purchase the toxic assets of the banks. All the trading activity and the holdings and the valuation of the assets were supposed to be disclosed on a timely basis. Not happening. He says, not only should this disclosure be required as a matter of basic transparency in the light of the billions of taxpayer dollars at stake per institution, but the disclosure should serve as a stated reason for the program in the first instance. None of it has happened. He writes, the Treasurer's default should be to require more disclosure, not less, to provide protection for the American taxpayers. But he says, unfortunately, in rejecting the basic transparency recommendations of SIGTARP, this has become a program in which, one, the taxpayers are not being told what the TARP recipients are doing with the money, they have still not been told how much their substantial investments are worth, and they will not be told in detail how their money has been used. In SIGTARP's view, the very credibility of TARP, and in large measure any chance of success, has depended on whether, in fact, the Treasury will commit in deed as in word the highest degree of transparency possible, writes Borofsky, and this is not taking place. He writes, the Treasury adopted SIGTARP's suggestions and developed provisions that made it a far better formula for compliance, but they have declined to adopt the most fundamental recommendations, that the Treasury would require impositions of an informational barrier or wall between the fund managers making the investment decisions on behalf of the banks and the employees of the fund management company who manage the funds. Treasury has decided not to impose such a wall, despite the fact that this is the predicate for the use of these funds in any way that would benefit the public or the economy. The reputational risk that Treasury and the program face if these massive profits that are being generated are not explained is a crisis in itself. And the failure to impose these requirements leaves us vulnerable to the accusation that the Treasury is really using TARP to pick winners and losers and granting the firms the right and the opportunity to exploit these funds strictly for their private gain and benefit. The reputational risk is not one that can be even measured in dollars and cents. It is rather a risk that puts in jeopardy the fragile trust the American people have in TARP, in the financial institutions, and by extension, in their government, he concludes.
Ralph, let's note that SIGTARP stands for the Office of the Special Inspector General, that's Borofsky, for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. He didn't limit himself to the TARP. He went on to look at all the programs that the Department of Treasury and the Federal Reserve have been creating. The report's estimate of the bailout of $23.7 trillion is a mind-boggling figure. It amounts to 1.7 times the entire gross domestic product of the United States. In other words, the product of more than a year's labor of all American workers, it's almost 2 years of labor of American workers, is being transferred to the banks. Andre Damon in the World Socialist website had a very interesting comment. He said, Borofsky's report reads more like a police dossier on a money laundering operation than a report on the activities of a government agency. This entire report is available on the internet. It's 252 pages. We're going to go over a certain section of it, the section that relates most of all to the creation of all these other programs for the banks and for the investment houses, for the mega insurance companies such as AIG, and also for the automakers, the bailouts of General Motors and others, how these programs were developed and how the Department of Treasury under the table is putting at risk $23.7 trillion of American money. The report is incredible, and the section starting on page 138 deals with all these various programs, such as term auction facility, and they have these various names, and the government even set up a special company called Maiden Lane, which dealt with the purchase of Bear Stearns and also the money that was given out to AIG. It's called the Maiden Lane LLC, and we'll discuss that too. Let's look at a few of these programs. We don't have time to go into each and every one of them, but let's look because it gives you a distinct idea of how the government is manipulating this money. One is the term auction facility, the TAF.
Well, Maya, the banks are manipulating the money, and as we will document in this program, the banks are the government.
But it's not just the banks that we would say are the government. We've done programs such as Lockheed for the military-industrial complex. They all go hand in hand, the ruling class. And this is the section of the ruling class with finance that supports all the various large corporations. And we are going to detail the interconnectedness between the finance sector and the U.S. government. The term auction facility allows banks to borrow funds simply by putting up collateral. It's an alternative to the Federal Reserve's discount window, and I'm reading from Borofsky's report, which is the means by which banks have historically raised funds in an emergency. The TAF was created in December 2007 by the Federal Reserve Board of Governors to meet the short-term liquidity needs of banks. Technically, the funds are borrowed by the banks in an auction that sets the interest rate. The bank must be in, quote, generally sound financial condition, and it must post collateral, such as high-quality notes, that are subject to certain haircuts. For example, the bank may borrow 92% after posting a dollar's worth of securities. And these are for short-term lending. The idea originally was that a program such as this $900 billion program, would increase the liquidity of the banks so that they could lend money. However, a study done by the SIGTARP agency found that banks have borrowed from the Federal Reserve and are using it to increase their reserves, that is, the money on their books, so it looks as if they are profitable, that they are stable, and that they can increase their share value. Ralph.
Well, what we're looking at here is a formula for taking any amount of money without any control. Here is an article in the Free Republic by Carl Denninger, and the headline is $24 trillion, ? The article says, Borofsky said that while the TARP program that Congress passed amounts to $700 billion, the total federal government support since 2007 for the financial sector will reach the far higher figure of $23.7 trillion, and the government has committed significantly more money than that to a variety of other federal agencies and programs. $23.7 trillion, Where was the congressional appropriation for that? This is blatantly unconstitutional. We're talking about double the nation's GDP in debt commitments, 33 times the amount that the public was informed of, 33 times the amount authorized by Congress. And he writes, it gets worse. Borofsky's office has opened 35 criminal investigations into issues of suspected accounting fraud, securities fraud, insider trading, mortgage or servicer misconduct, mortgage fraud, public corruption, false statements, and taxes. That's right. 35 criminal investigations are connected to this $24 trillion of largesse. And that's only what Borofsky knows about. He's the first to say he only knows a part of it. Anyone care to gander at what's hidden from him? He says, quote, Treasury's continued unwillingness to provide basic transparency, despite the recommendations of SIGCARP and Congress and the repeated demonstration that meaningful data from TARP recipients can be gathered and disseminated, is unacceptable, said a memo prepared by Republicans on the Oversight Committee. Richard Nixon, bailout gate, anyone? Obstruction? This is outrageous. It threatens the stability of our society. How can anyone believe our banking system or our nation's treasury can survive the exposure of $24 trillion, twice our GDP, writes this conservative publication.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Finance Plutocracy and the $24 Trillion Heist. Ralph?
This article continues as follows. If creditors and lenders, notably China and Japan, wise up to what's going on, the game will be quite literally over as soon as right now. Market technicians have noted patterns in the market that have potential downside targets of zero. That sort of thing normally results in a loud guffaw. Well, I think we've found something here that predicts the outcome of this crisis. We need cops. We need them right now, before our creditors cut off our credit cards, before the nation's economy is destroyed, before the whole societal structure implodes, he writes.
Well, Ralph, these are liberals who are really worried about the revelation of things we have been talking about.
Well,
forever
actually,
and ever. This
well,
is
Maya,
the
actually,
basic structure of capitalism.
Yes, it is. But I just want to mention, liberals indeed are a part of this, but Free Republic is actually a conservative publication. It's not. It's across the board. And that's what I just want to say this, Maya, that we have been showing from Bloomberg News, from the Financial Times, from the U.S. News and World Report, from the organs of finance capital, from Business Week, that the analysis of this crisis could come right out of Das Kapital, right out. They talk structurally. They talk institutionally. They talk about an inexorable crisis. They talk about a runaway captivity of the society by greedy banksters who actually run the show and for whom there is no exit except the accumulation of yet ever-increasing volume of the assets and value of the society without any consideration, without any ability to address the debt crisis, the fictive capital crisis that flows from this.
Well, you set up a public-private partnership, the Federal Reserve, on whose board members are the banks themselves and which is owned by the banks. And the intent of the Federal Reserve is to preserve the banking structure, the finance structure. And then, during the Clinton administration, you have the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, Robert Rubin, as your Treasury Secretary. And what does he do? He convinces the administration that it should eliminate Glass-Steagall, which was the Depression-era legislation that prevented banks from operating like investment houses, essentially functioning on Wall Street, too. You eliminate it, and you have the banking structure of the United States setting up these derivatives, of which there is no regulation. And consequently, when there is the inevitable speculative fallout, what do you have? You have the government stepping in, and again, another CEO of Goldman Sachs at the top of the financial apparatus of the Treasury Department. And what does he say? We've got to have this bailout. Otherwise, this financial collapse is just too big and it'll be the entire collapse of the United States. And then what do you have? You have, as the Federal Reserve and the Department of Treasury, setting up, as the SICTARP report elaborates, not only using the funds that Congress allocates, but then mushrooming it, ballooning it into all these secretive programs. Secretive with no reporting. You've got to look at this report to read about each and every one of them. It is totally revealing. Ralph?
Fox News, $23.7 trillion bailout. The total price for support stemming from the financial crisis will exceed $23.7 trillion, the government's top bailout watchdog says in his new report to Congress. And it goes on to quote the comment of Representative Darrell Issa, the ranking Republican on the Oversight Committee. The potential financial commitment that the United States taxpayers have made and for which they are responsible is of a size and scope that cannot even be imagined, he wrote. If you spent $1 million a day going back to the birth of Christ, it wouldn't even come close to just $1 trillion. This is a staggering figure, a devastating revelation. Wall Street Journal, $23.7 trillion, and prepare testimony for a hearing of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Special Inspector General Neil Barofsky said the figure, including spending commitments aimed at supporting the economy and the U.S. financial system, is completely out of control. The top Republican has acknowledged that the $23.7 trillion is a staggering figure that puts the entire society at risk. The Wall Street Journal is supplemented by the World Socialist website in its critique, which essentially draws upon the same data and draws the appropriate conclusion. The report notes that in 9 months since the creation of the Troubled Asset Release Program, 12 separate programs and private funds that had added up to $3 trillion have now been dwarfed by dozens of programs that were not acknowledged that reach up to $23.7 trillion. And it says, the report estimate of the bailout's total is in itself mind-boggling, 1.7 times the gross domestic product of the entire United States. In other words, the product of more than a year's labor for every American worker has been transferred directly to the banks. To put this figure in perspective, the government's total outlay for discretionary spending, including education, food and nutrition programs and housing and urban development, is under $1 trillion a year. This massive transfer of wealth entails the immiseration and impoverishment of the great majority of society. The bank bailout program and the bankers who have benefited are no better than criminals. This has explosive implications. It is the recognition of this fact and the desire to make the Treasury thieving less blatant that the document warns that Treasury actions could put in jeopardy the fragile trust the American people have in TARP and, by extension, their government. This bank bailout, designed from the start to enrich the financial elite at the expense of everyone else, was presented as relief for an economic crisis. In fact, the favoritism and the loopholes are not a rough patch in an otherwise sound program. They are essential not merely to its aim. The entire thing is a crime of historic importance.
Ralph, I think we need to go into how it is done, because it is in the details that what they are doing becomes clear, and that is setting up program after program that lends the banks more money. I had mentioned the first, and another one for $111.9 billion is called the Primary Credit Program, and that is also known as the Discount Program Modification, where primary credit loans are taken by banks at the Federal Reserve's discount window, where they require short-term funds to meet the needs of their customers and creditors. Normally, the Federal Reserve lends at a fixed rate, and the bank must again post suitable collateral subject to a haircut. But in August 2007, the Federal Reserve set the term at 30 days, and it approved a 50 basis point reduction, and then broadened this in March 2008. And the interest rate was lowered, making it easier for the banks to borrow money. And then it also increased the time in which the banks had to pay it back from 30 days, that's 1 month essentially, to 90 days, that's 3 months, and it was renewable by the borrower. In other words, the banks could keep renewing or postponing when they were going to pay back the Federal Reserve. These are just two of the programs. There are many of them. There are 12 to 13 of them, and each one has the same effect, lending money and delaying when that money can be paid back. And it's not just to the banks. Again, it was the bailout of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and also the bailout of AIG, the automakers, and then breaking up the automakers, laying off the workers, and then they'll be selling off the assets. The benefit goes to the investors, such as Warren Buffett, and to these finance institutions like Goldman Sachs. And that leads us to how we're going to conclude today's show, and with the discussion of who are these financiers. Ralph?
The New York Times, on October 19th, 2008, published an article called "The Guys from Government Sachs" by Julie Creswell and Ben White. This summer, when the Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson Jr. sought help navigating the Wall Street meltdown, he turned to his old firm, Goldman Sachs, snagging a handful of former bankers and experts in corporate restructuring. In September, after the government bailed out the American International Group, the faltering insurance giant, for $85 billion, Mr. Paulson selected a director from Goldman's own board to lead AIG. And earlier this month, Mr. Paulson needed someone to oversee the government's proposed $700 billion bailout fund, so he again recruited someone with a Goldman Sachs pedigree. He gave the post to a 35-year-old former investment banker who, before coming to the Treasury Department, had little background in housing finance. Indeed, writes Julie Creswell and Ben White of the New York Times, Goldman Sachs' presence in the department and around the federal response to the financial crisis is so ubiquitous that other bankers have given the star-studded firm a new nickname, Government Sachs. The power and influence that Goldman wields at the nexus of politics and finance is no accident. Long regarded as the savviest firm among the ranks, now decimated, of Wall Street investment banks, it has a history and a culture of encouraging its partners to take leadership roles in the government. It is a widely held view within the bank that no matter how much money you pile up, you are not a Goldman star until you make your mark in the political sphere and exercise political control. Goldman sees this as little more than making sure that executives of their firm have an opportunity to dictate policy. They note that decisions that Paulson and other Goldman alumni make at Treasury directly affect the firm's own fortunes. The questions are why Goldman, which with other firms have helped fuel the financial crisis, has such a strong hand in trying to resolve it. The very scale of the financial calamity and the historic government response to it has spawned a host of questions about Goldman's role. Analysts wonder, write the New York Times, why hasn't Mr. Paulson hired other individuals from other banks to limit the appearance that the Treasury Department has become a de facto division of Goldman Sachs? Others ask, whose interests Mr. Paulson and his coterie of former Goldman executives have in mind? Those overseeing tottering financial service firms or homeowners squeezed by the crisis, writes the New York Times. Still other questions, whether Goldman alumni leading the federal bailout are motivated by something other than their own interest, whether Mr. Paulson has cast the net wide enough to ensure that any kind of innovative response could be pursued. He's brought on people who have the same life experience and ideology as does he, said William Black, associate professor of law and economics at the University of Missouri, and counsel to the Federal Home Loan Bank Board during the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. These are the people trained by Paulson at Goldman Sachs, evaluated by Paulson, so their mindset is not just shaped in generalized groupthink, it's specific Paulson groupthink. There is a clear, demonstrable exercise of control by the bankers, and in particular by the Goldman Sachs and the speculative institutions of finance capital. Mr. Paulson himself landed atop the Treasury because of his Goldman tie. Joshua Bolton, the former Goldman executive and President Bush's chief of staff, recruited Paulson to the post. There's one thing Goldman has. It is an imposing army of top of their class. The most prominent former Goldman banker now working for Mr. Paulson at Treasury is perhaps the most unlikely. Neil T. Kashkari, this article in the New York Times tells us, in 2008. He arrived in 2006, spending 2 years as a technology investment banker for Goldman in San Francisco. Before joining Goldman, he had 2 engineering degrees, in addition to an MBA from the Wharton School, working on projects for the space company TRW that belongs to Northrop Grumman. He was appointed to oversee a $700 billion fund that Paulson orchestrated to buy toxic and complex bank assets.
And that's the TARP.
The TARP. And the role evolved as his boss decided to invest taxpayer money directly in troubled financial institutions. It's a long article, brothers and sisters. Who controls the bailout? The very people who are the beneficiaries of it. Who dictates the policy? The authors of the banking crisis, the crisis of fictive capital. As the article in the Interpress Service on July 25th of this year writes, trillions to the banks and the taxpayers are left in the dark. Maya.
Ralph, let's look at another one of the stars of the financial bailout, in other words, gift to the financiers. And if you look at the $100 million bonuses that are being discussed, particularly to the head of one of the trading operations of Citigroup, yes, the energy trading group, the head of it, Mr. Hall, has $100 million coming to him. One of the so-called stars of the bailout is Stephen Friedman, who's also another former head of Goldman Sachs. Friedman was both a director of the company and a chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank when it was preparing the details of the Wall Street bailout. The president of the New York Fed at the time, Timothy Geithner, who's now the secretary of the treasurer, requested a conflict of interest waiver that would allow Friedman to buy more Goldman Sachs stock at the time. And Friedman ended up with 98,600 shares. At the market close, this was worth $14,756,476. But that's nothing. 3 years ago, the 50 top Goldman execs made $20 million each. And this year, that's going to be even better. Ralph?
Well, Robert Scheer, in the article Government Sachs Strikes Gold Again on July 14th, writes, connect the dots. Goldman Sachs made $3.44 billion in profit in this one quarter, while the U.S. deficit topped $1 trillion for the first time in the nation's history and is headed towards doubling that figure before this budget year is out. This increase in the federal deficit is directly due to bailing out the banks. Well, that's because the plan was devised by Bush Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. Remember that Lehman Brothers, Goldman's competitor, was allowed to go bankrupt. The Paulson crowd wouldn't let Lehman change his status to that of a bank holding company to qualify for federal funds. Soon afterward, Goldman was granted such a deal worth a quick $10 billion. Much is made of Goldman paying back part of its bailout, but forgotten is the $12.9 billion that Goldman got as a payoff. And indeed, that money will not be paid back. Now, Maya, in the New York Times on April 27, 2009, the Treasury Secretary Paulson has been replaced by a new Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, the former head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank and the point man in this entire bankster process. This is the man who has guided the policy and who has dictated policy for his actual, the only word to use is puppet, Barack Obama. Joe Becker and Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times. Geithner, member and overseer of the Finance Club, is the headline. Last June, with a financial hurricane gathering force, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson convened the nation's economic stewards for a brainstorming session. What emergency powers might the government want at its disposal to confront the crisis, he asked. Timothy F. Geithner, president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, overseeing most of the nation's most powerful institutions, stunned the group with the audacity of his answer. He proposed requesting Congress to give the president broad power to guarantee all the debt in the banking system, according to two participants, including Michelle Davis, then Assistant Treasury Secretary. The proposal quickly died amidst protests that it was politically untenable because it would put the taxpayers on the hook for trillions of dollars. Quote, people thought, wow, that's kind of out there, said John C. Dugan, the controller of the currency, who heard about the idea afterwards. But in the 10 months since then, the government has embraced this blue sky prescription, step by step, by an array of new programs. The Federal Reserve and Treasury, the New York Times writes, assumed an unprecedented role in the banking system, using unprecedented amounts of taxpayer money to save the nation's financiers from their own mistakes. Mr. Geithner is the leading architect of these bailouts, the activist at the head of the pack, the federal regulator most willing to push the envelope, said H. Rodin Cohen, the prominent Wall Street lawyer who spoke frequently with Geithner. Today, Mr. Geithner's Treasury Secretary, as he seeks to rebuild the nation's fractured financial system with more taxpayer benevolence, he finds himself the focus of discontent. Even as banks complain that the government has attached intrusive strings to its financial assistance, lawmakers, economists, and even former Federal Reserve colleagues say the bailout that Mr. Geithner has played such a central role in fashioning is vastly generous to the financial system at taxpayers' expense. This article documents the insider role of Geithner as the hired hand of Goldman Sachs and of the bankers.
Ralph, Timothy Geithner is a protege of Robert Rubin. Robert Rubin had been the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Then he was the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton. And after he left the Clinton administration, he became a director of Citigroup. And it was under Robert Rubin that Citigroup ended up purchasing even more financial institutions to become the largest bank in the world. Geithner, during his role as the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, had lunch with senior executives often, and his calendar was published when he was seeking the position of Treasury Secretary. The New York Times then studied it. He ate lunch with senior executives from Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley at the Four Seasons restaurant or in their corporate dining rooms. He attended casual dinners at the homes of executives like Jamie Dimon, a member of the New York Fed Board and chief of J.P. Morgan Chase. He was particularly close to executives of Citigroup, the largest bank under his supervision, Robert Rubin, a senior Citi executive and former Treasury Secretary, was Mr. Geithner's mentor from his years in the Clinton administration, and the two kept in close touch in New York. He frequently met with Sanford Weill, one of Citi's largest individual shareholders and its former chairman, serving on the board of a charity Mr. Weill led. As the bank was entering a financial tailspin, Mr. Weill approached Mr. Geithner about taking over as Citi's chief executive. This is a position that Mr. Geithner did not take. In fact, he ended up with an even higher position, that of Secretary of the Treasury. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. William Poole, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis until March 2008, has stated that the Fed, by effectively, the New York Times writes, creating money out of thin air, not only runs the risk of massive inflation, but has done a total end run around congressional power to control spending. In making the Bear Stearns deal, for example, the New York Fed under Timothy Geithner accepted Bear's own calculation of value of assets acquired with taxpayer money, even though those values would certainly decline as the economy deteriorated. The Fed officials argued they can hold on to the assets until they increase in value, and meanwhile the taxpayers lost an immediate $3.4 billion, and those losses are understated, given how the Federal Reserve priced the holdings, said Janet Tavakoli, president of Tavakoli Structured Finance. You can assume it has used magical thinking in valuing these assets, she states. In other words, they simply decree an arbitrary value to the assets that has no remote relationship to reality. That money is handed over to Bear Stearns or whoever the player is. Quote, Mr. Geithner played the pivotal role in the next big bailout, which was even bigger. American International Group, the insurance giant whose derivatives business had brought it to the brink of collapse. Geithner then went to bat for Goldman Sachs, the insurer's biggest trading partner. As AIG bordered on bankruptcy, Geithner pressed first for the private sector solution. AIG needed $60 billion it had written to protect against debt defaults. The chief executive, Robert Willemstad, said he hired bankers at J.P. Morgan to help it raise capital. Goldman Sachs jockeyed for the job as well. Mr. Willemstad rejected the idea. The potential conflict of interest, he feared, was too great. But on Monday, September 15th, Mr. Geithner pushed AIG to bring Goldman onto its team to raise the capital. In short, Goldman Sachs, with Geithner as well as all the others, called the shots. Maya, banks own the government, writes Dean Baker in the London Guardian on June 30th. Last month, when the U.S. Congress failed to pass a bankruptcy reform measure that would allow home mortgages to be modified in bankruptcy, Senator Dick Durbin succinctly commented, "The banks owned the place." This is an article in The Guardian which lays out the actual method of control. And indeed, in The Coloradan, David Sirota says, the one percenters, that is to say, the 1% whose share of America's total income is the highest since 1929, run the show and enjoy unprecedented protection. Trillions to banks as the taxpayers are left in the dark, and Buffett's Goldman stake pays richly, writes Zachary Coey in the New York Times on July 24th. The kleptocracy reigns. The figures who are exercising the essential decision-making come out of the banking apparatus of Goldman Sachs in particular. They run the entire operation. It has now reached proportions of $24 trillion. The so-called stimulus will have no impact whatsoever on the economy of the United States. We will discuss the crisis for working people and the mass of our population in shows to come, brothers and sisters. The kleptocracy reigns. Obama is the facilitator, and we are his victims.
This is Taking Aim,
with Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Finance Plutocracy and the $24 million Heist, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com.